through reasons to believe. And, you know, I typically start off those skeptics forums by giving like a 3 or 4 minute description of a new scientific discovery that gives more evidence for the Christian faith. But last Sunday morning, a number of you came up to me afterwards and said, couldn't you find something a little closer to home than the bulk flow to talk about? And you're just a little too esoteric and far away. Those of you that weren't there, I was describing the very distant distribution of very distant dark matter in the universe, and how it demonstrates that the Bible is true and shows design. But I thought I would give you one as a substitute, because I know this is November, and November is a month we celebrate Thanksgiving. And I was suggesting that you could thank God for the bulk flow, but let me give you another one you can thank God for. This just got published Thursday afternoon, electronically, and it'll be coming out this week in the Science magazine. And it's a series of 3 articles, and it actually made a big play on the web as well. Some research done on chemotactic marine bacteria. Maybe you've never heard of these chemotactic marine bacteria, but we have a lot to thank God for these bacteria. Why? Because they are the bacteria that feed in all the waste products of phytoplankton. And phytoplankton are the dominant plant species on our planet today. 70% of photosynthetic life on planet Earth is phytoplankton. And, you know, they expel a lot of waste. Somebody has to clean up after these phytoplankton. And it's the chemotactic marine bacteria that do that. Or as my sons once said when they were 5 and 6 years old, who takes care of all the fish poop in the oceans? I mean, this happened one time. We were going to the beach, and they said, look at all the fish here. They said, yeah, but they're all pooping in the water. They were a little bit worried about that. Well, as this article points out, it's the chemotactic marine bacteria that feed on that fish poop and reprocess it for the benefit of all life. And really what the papers, that's actually 3 papers, are all about is how these chemotactic marine bacteria will feed on these waste products and then process it into minerals, and the minerals basically fertilize the ocean and make possible abundant phytoplankton. So it's actually part of the cycle of life, in the sense of the phytoplankton are those creatures that are taking water and carbon dioxide and using that to make oxygen that all of us animals can breathe, but also they provide food. That's the byproduct of their photosynthesis. They make sugar, starches, and fats, and they pump oxygen in the atmosphere. And for those of you concerned about global warming, they're the primary life out there that is soaking greenhouse gases out of the atmosphere. Those greenhouse gases are predominantly carbon dioxide and water vapor. And so one reason why you can thank God this Thanksgiving is for all those phytoplankton, but also for these chemotactic marine bacteria that basically take the waste of these phytoplankton and the fish poop and process it back into minerals that makes it possible for us to have such an abundance of photosynthetic life on here on planet Earth. But the heart of the paper was actually an argument for life design. I mean, something you see in the creation Psalms we're looking at, particularly Psalm 104, is how God has optimally designed all life here on planet Earth. And what they're discovering about these chemotactic marine bacteria is how optimally designed they are to be able to feed on these waste products. And it's actually 2 different research groups, one kind of looking at the physics of water in the oceans, and recognizing if you look at the world's oceans, they're very homogeneous and uniform on large scales, but in very small scales, scales that are small enough to be of particular importance to these bacteria, the ocean is not homogeneous and uniform. In fact, what you discover is that on very small scales, the ocean waters can be described as filaments and voids, which was kind of intriguing to me as an astronomer and as a cosmologist, because that's the way the universe is like. If we look at the universe as a whole, we see that the galaxies and clusters of galaxies are distributed along these thin filaments and sheets, and in between are these big voids. Well, we're now finding the same thing's true of ocean water, that the nutrients, which would be the waste products of the fish poop and the waste products of the phytoplankton, because of the dynamics of ocean water, the physics of the ocean water, wind up being concentrated along these thin filaments and sheets with voids of nutrients in between, which means that the bacteria have got a problem. They have to find some way to move from the regions of voids in the ocean water where the nutrients are of very low abundance and come into contact with these filaments where they're there in concentrated forms. And so what they're discovering about these chemotactic marine bacteria is that they have built within them appendages that allow for limited mobility. Now, of course, a classic example of this with bacteria would be the flagellum and the motor associated with it. Well, what they're finding in these bacteria is that they're finding the equivalent of a flagellum, but one that doesn't take that much energy. Because after all, a bacteria doesn't have to move very far to find one of these filaments or sheets. And if they have a full mobility, they'd be consuming way too much energy to get to the nutrient zones. So what we notice is that these mobile appendages are optimized where the bacteria get to spend the minimum amount of energy necessary to get to the filaments and feed. And so one whole paper was talking about optimal foraging strategies on part of the bacteria and optimal foraging equipment built into the bacteria to enable them to get to these things without spending that much energy. And so their whole point is there's two levels of design. There's a physical and chemical level of design in the oceans itself that takes all these nutrients and concentrates them in filaments. Because after all, if it was evenly distributed, then it'd be far more challenging for these bacteria to process these waste products. But the fact that there is a design in the ocean water that actually concentrates them on these tiny filaments and sheets means that it's actually possible for these bacteria to efficiently process. If it wasn't for the filaments in these ocean waters, then these bacteria, no matter how abundant they were, would not be able to effectively recycle these waste products into the minerals that are necessary to sustain phytoplankton at a maximum abundance. And phytoplankton, just to remind you, are the base of the food chain in the ocean. The zooplankton feed on the phytoplankton. Small fish feed on the zooplankton. Bigger fish feed on the small fish. Sharks feed on the big fish, and we eat the sharks. So, yes?
If I remember correctly from the previous thank God and Thanksgiving for whale feces.
Right.
That the plankton survive on that.
Right.
But the plankton were around billions of years before the whales came along. So how did that all work out?
Well, this is the theme you see in Psalm 104, that God over the whole history of the earth is packing the earth with as much life as possible, as diverse as possible, for as long as possible, building up to human beings. And when we human beings come upon the terrestrial scene, this is when the abundance and diversity of life has hit a maximal peak. And so, yeah, it takes time. And now what you notice with whales, for example, in the context of, say, global warming, and in terms of using their poop to fertilize the photic zone in the ocean, we notice over the history of the Earth that it's progressive. Whales start off in freshwater only, and then they begin to multiply in terms of number of species and number of individuals, where not only are they in freshwater, and we're talking 50, 60 million years ago, all you got is freshwater whales. And then they move into what are called estuaries, which are the mouths of rivers where it's partly salt and partly fresh. And then they're able to eventually move into a completely saltwater environment where you have many species where whales fill all the oceans of the world, and therefore they're able to fully fertilize the photic zone, which is necessary in the context of a sun that's getting brighter and brighter with respect to time. Because the sun gets brighter and brighter, you want life on planet Earth to become progressively more efficient and drawing greenhouse gases out of the atmosphere. So as the sun is getting brighter and therefore hotter, the temperature in the surface of the Earth remains ideal for all life, because the life that God puts here in the Earth in a progressive fashion, drawing more greenhouse gases to the atmosphere, means that our atmosphere over time becomes less and less efficient in trapping heat. Right now, our atmosphere raises the temperature of the surface of the Earth by 33 degrees. But in the past, it was raising it by 60 degrees. And so by dropping it down from 60 degrees to 33 degrees, that perfectly compensates for the fact that the sun is now brighter than it was, 1, 2, 3 billion years ago.
So you're saying the phytoplankton before whales were around would feed on other substances?
We didn't need as much phytoplankton.
And there wasn't as many.
There wasn't as much phytoplankton back then. But because of the fact that we got the whales fertilizing the photic zone, it's now possible for the oceans to sustain a much larger population of a phytoplankton, which means the oceans can also sustain a much larger population of fish, and thereby a larger population of whales. So it all works out. What about all the stuff we dump in? Well, that's why we got seagulls, right? So, well, it's still the case that these phytoplankton and the fish are dumping more waste products into the oceans than we are. But yeah, you're raising a good issue. With 7 billion people on the planet, our waste products are no longer trivial. And, people are worried that that could upset the balance, as they are worried that human activity could upset the planet's temperature balance. So,
do you think it will? I mean, the ocean?
Well, I don't know of any significant research that's been able to really quantify that at this point. There's a lot of interest in trying to quantify the human component in global warming. There we do have some numbers, but personally I don't know of numbers about the waste we're putting into the oceans and what's happening there. Fortunately, the oceans are pretty salty, so that really helps. But I don't know. Maybe the biologists in this class can research that for us. So, but frankly, I don't know for sure if that's the case. So, anyway, just wanted to give you another thing you can thank God for come Thanksgiving. And you'll listen to our podcast at reasons.org. We're actually releasing this next week a number of recent news stories that give you brand new reasons to thank God on Thanksgiving. So check that out. In fact, I'll just tease you with one of them. It's the fact that there's now got a research project about how rats can control human avatars. Can you believe that? Yeah, they're actually doing experiments where we're actually making robotic rats that humans control to relate to rats. But they've actually done the reverse, where they've made a human-type robot, a robot that looks like a human being, that a rat can control, so that these rats can actually interact through us human beings through, quote, a robotic avatar.
Who pays for this?
Who pays for this?
Our tax dollars are at work.
Your tax dollars are at work. So if you listen to our podcast, it actually does have tremendous potential for research on human-animal interactive behavior. For doing research on rat-rat behavior, for example, and would be particularly helpful if you're trying to do animal research on animal species that are especially dangerous to human beings. Like supposing you want to study rhinoceros behavior, you can actually build a robotic rhinoceros that you can control to interact with the other rhinos out there, or crocodiles, or hippos, or pythons, or whatever else you want to do research on. Politicians. Well, you should have heard the sermon this morning. Eh? I don't know how many of you attended the sermon this morning. I did not know that the word politics is based on two Greek words, poly and tix. Take it as you were. So, hopefully I won't get Paul Beck into too much trouble with that one. So, this isn't exactly out of the realm of technical capability, because I was reading in this article, there's actually two airports where instead of being greeted by an employee that tells you where your connecting flight is, you're greeted by an avatar. It's not really an avatar. What it is a human being hologram, a holographic image of a human being that's computer controlled, where the holographic image tells you where your connecting flight is. So That way you don't have to pay all these employees. You just have these different holographic images waiting for you there. And probably you'll be checking your baggage with holographic images next. I don't know. So, which means we should be able to save a lot of labor and use it for other purposes.
Can we do the body
searches? My wife asked me that question. I said, well, it depends how much money you want to invest into the robotic avatar, what you can do. Anyway, I recommend the podcast on the reasons.org website. And by the way, you don't need a computer. We actually have all these loaded on our phone app. So if you've got a smartphone, you can check it out. But I just want to alert you that this week we're releasing a whole bunch of these things that you can thank God for. Well, what I really want to do today is see if we can wrap up our study in Psalm 139 and move us into Psalm 147 and 148. Those of you that are new to the class, what we've been doing in this class over the past, several years now, is working our way from Genesis 1 to Revelation 22, where we actually look at every creation text of major significance in the Bible. Major significance where you've got at least half a chapter or more of content dealing with the subject of creation theology. And right now, we're working our way through Psalm 139, which is the primary biblical text that deals with the subject of human origins. And I've been going through a long keynote presentation, and hey, believe it or not, we're down to just a few more slides and we're done, and we can move to Psalm 147 and 148. If you want to read ahead, we're going to look at those two psalms together, because you'll see that they address the same subject matter. So, and by the way, the chapter divisions are arbitrary. So, those are two songs that David or someone else might have written, but we're going to study them together. But what we've been dealing with is this subject of junk DNA, and it's a hot topic these days in terms of a debate between creationists and evolutionists. And it's that the core of the debate, and this is really significant, and this is one area where you can really test the differences between a spectrum of creation models and a spectrum of evolution models. And I want to make that point because there's not just one creation model out there, not even just one biblical creation model. There's several biblical creation models. There's also several evolutionary models, some of which are naturalistic, others are theistic. But from an evolutionary perspective, if you're looking at the human genome, from an evolutionary perspective, you would predict that our genome would have the greatest percentage or quantity of junk compared to the genomes of all life forms. Why? Because we're the most recently appeared life form. We're also the most complex. And the thinking is that we are the product of common descent from an ancestor that lived before us. Since we're the last on the scene, the whole idea is that through evolutionary process, every time one ancestor produces a new species, it passes junk along. And so as you go from one species to the next species to the next species through common descent, you would expect that the amount of junk would accumulate from one species to the next. Therefore, our species should have the most junk DNA. Now, from a creationist perspective, where we believe that God is the one that actually designs each DNA genome. In other words, it's common design, not common descent. And common design in the sense of what's optimal for a chimpanzee, in many respects, will also be optimal for a human being. After all, both species have a heart. And so what's good for a human heart is also going to be good for the hearts of many other mammalian creatures. And therefore, you'd expect to see a common design there. However, it also tells us in Romans chapter 8 that the entire creation is subject to decay. Everything starts decaying once God creates it. So the moment God creates it, it starts decaying. Now, if we're talking about a species of life that's been here on planet Earth for a long period of time, like a cockroach, you'd expect that there'd be quite a bit of decay, genetic decay, built up in the genome of the cockroach. But since we human beings have only been here for a few tens of thousands of years, we should have the minimum amount of accumulated junk. Because after all, we haven't been subject to this pervasive law of decay, the second law of thermodynamics. And there's been creationists, for example, writing books on genetic decay, where they kind of look at the genomes of different species and try to calculate how much decay should accumulate over a period of time, and using that as an argument against an evolutionary paradigm. But where evolutionists, this goes back about 20 years ago now, claimed that they had the upper hand in the creation-evolution debate is that they noticed, when you look at the human genome, only 2% of our genome codes for proteins. And therefore, they concluded that the other 98% is junk accumulated through hundreds of millions of years of common descent and evolution. And the whole point here is that they were looking for design in the context of the fact that they believe that the genome served the sole purpose of providing blueprints for building all the different proteins. Now, if we're talking a human being, we have a lot of proteins, a lot more than a cockroach. But we have a huge genome, too. And, you know, with 3 million base pairs, that's a really big genome, but only 2% of it actually codes, provides the blueprints for making the proteins. And indeed, that is a function that the DNA serves, is to provide all the blueprints for building all the complex molecules that we see within the organism. Yes?
Ever since we've been talking about junk DNA, the amount of junk DNA, as we study it, goes down and down and down.
Well, the reason why the percentage of junk DNA in the human genome has been progressively declining over the past 20 years is that over those past 20 years, geneticists have been looking for design in other areas besides the coding of proteins. And actually, the credit for all this goes back almost 30 years now, no, about 25 years, to a group of physicists. So how did physicists get involved in this? Well, it's a group of physicists who were involved in trying to simulate the kind of software that we see in the DNA. And so what they did is they built some or designed some computer programs to look for language complexity in the genome. And they felt, well, hey, if 2% is showing some level of purpose and design and 98% is junk, then we're going to find a lot more language complexity in the 2% than the 98%. So they wrote these programs and ran them and published a paper in a mathematics journal, but then they wound up publishing it again in a biology journal, so they published it in two places, one for all those geeks in the hard sciences and then for the ones in the life sciences. But what they were announcing was, to their great surprise, they found greater language complexity in the 98% than they did the 2%. And so they kind of announced that to the genetics community. There must be design in that 98% that we've overlooked. How else can we explain the fact that it's showing higher language complexity than the 2% that codes for proteins? And maybe what that 98% is actually doing is something far more complex than simply providing the blueprints for the proteins, as complex as that might be.
My question to you is, if that amount is going further and further down, do you think even with the decay that we're experiencing, we might get to the point where we find out that there really isn't anything, that junk DNA doesn't really exist, that there isn't any system?
Well, that is a good point. You know, if human beings have only been around for, say, 40 to 80,000 years, how much junk is actually going to accumulate in our genome? It's not going to be very high. It might be as low as 0.1%. I mean, I don't know of any genetic study that's actually tried to predict that, other than what I've seen coming from the young Earth creationist community, which has the problem of adopting models that are not realistic. they actually come up with a very high percentage, and frankly, I think the percentage is going to be lower than what they're talking about. So yeah, that's kind of an area that needs some research study, is to actually try to determine the impact of thermodynamics in degrading the human genome over a period of time. But I mean, we can kind of see some evidence for that. The very fact that the human species today is carrying a heavier load of diabetics than it was, say, 2,000 years ago. although some have argued it's because we live longer and a lot of forms of diabetes don't show up until later in life. But even childhood diabetes, the percentage is much higher than what it used to be. And so, yeah, there does seem to be certain genetic diseases that are impacting humanity that weren't anywhere near the problem it was thousands of years ago. Okay, question over here.
I'm just wondering, in terms of the junk DNA, then, as far as other similar creatures like chimpanzees and our other nearest relatives, are they doing a comparison of junk DNA on them compared to us, and are they full of junk DNA and we're not?
Well, that is one of the primary arguments that you're hearing from both atheistic evolutionists and theistic evolutionists. They'll look at the genome of, say, the bonobo or the chimpanzee or the orangutan, all of which we now have, and compare it with human beings, and they'll say, notice that these species are all carrying the same junk DNA, and therefore we must be the product of common descent from some primate species that gave rise to chimpanzees, orangutans, and human beings, because we all have the same junk. However, that's being challenged by researchers saying what you thought was common junk is actually common design, in the sense that now that we understand that portion of the genome a little bit better, we realize that that is controlling certain features that are crucial in the development of all four species. And so that's kind of where the debate is running right now. What is the actual junk, and is it really junk, or does it have a purpose in it? And I think I mentioned last 2 weeks ago that one of the scholars that they were recruiting for Reasons to Believe is a gal at Caltech who's just finished her PhD, and it's a brand new discipline at Caltech looking at the control systems within the DNA that governs the molecules that have all the blueprints. And my wife and I got to attend her thesis defense, and her opening statement in her thesis defense was, quote, "It is extremely challenging to explain the origin and operation of complexity inside the cells, but it's far more difficult yet to explain the origin and the operation of the control systems that manage the complexity." And this is kind of what they're finding in the human genome, is just how much of that 98% is there to control the part of the genome that actually has all the blueprints in it for the different molecules. Question from you, John.
I'm just thinking the term junk itself means it's something that you don't see any use or purpose for, and you seem like you can't figure it out, so therefore it must be junk. And therefore this assumption that what's not understood about the functioning of the DNA is basically just a display of ignorance.
Well, that's what I would call the rummage sale paradigm. I mean, for you, it's junk. People going to the room and say, hey, I can use that for purpose X, Y, or Z. And so we're discovering that that indeed is the case, and this is why I want to segue to this next section. And you'll actually find a good summary of this in the book that Fuzz and I wrote, Who is Adam? It's a whole book that I think we got over there that deals with the subject of human origins. Yes.
And isn't that the history of science, that, you know, everything turns out to be a lot more complex than it appeared some few decades ago.
Well, I'm going to suggest that what we're seeing here for the human genome is actually true of all the sciences. And it's something you see throughout the book of Job and the creation songs, is that if you look, you'll see the handiwork of God. And the more you look, the more you'll see the handiwork of God. And rather than calling it junk or calling it useless or having no purpose, maybe we need to dig a little bit deeper and see the hidden purpose and design that we haven't yet recognized. I mean, my own discipline of astronomy, we see that. There are astronomers out there who say, look at all these useless stars, 50 billion trillion stars. If God wanted life on planet Earth, why did he create all that useless junk? Well, we now know that every one of those 50 billion trillion stars plays a critical role in making advanced life possible here on planet Earth. By the way, it's a theme you're going to see in Psalm 147 and 148, how God knows the numbers of all the stars, counts them, has given a name to each one of them, and kind of making the implicit remark that all those stars serve a critical function. And indeed, we know that that is true for many reasons. You want to check up on it, you can get my book, Why the Universe is the Way It Is. So we look at the vastness of the universe, there's no junk there. All of it serves a purpose. And likewise, you can see that in any discipline of science. I mean, why all these life forms, millions of life forms on planet Earth? They now count that there's 8.8 million, plus or minus 2 million species of eukaryotic life forms on planet Earth. According to Job and Psalms, they all serve a purpose in meeting the needs of human beings. We don't know what all that is yet, but if we look, we'll find it. Well, getting back to the subject of our genome. Okay, that 98% that they call junk breaks down into five basic categories. Pseudogenes, and you can tell by the very name that these are genes that are fake genes. They really don't operate like genes. Genes are the ones that have the blueprints to make all these complex molecules. And then we got what are called signs. Now, it's not just astronomers that like acronyms. It turns out biologists and geneticists like acronyms too. What does sign stand for? Short interspersed nuclear elements. And the pieces of nuclear elements are the nucleotides that exist inside the DNA. And then we've got the lines, and obviously that means the long interspersed nuclear elements. And then we've got what are called endogenous retroviruses, and evolutionists were presuming that what's happening with our genome is that we have viruses that have been incorporated into our DNA. So it's not that God designed that part of the DNA, it's actually viruses that we picked up over hundreds of millions of years of evolution. So it's viruses that kind of dwell inside our genome. And then we got what are called the LTRs, which are long terminal repeats. Okay, what I'm going to do is kind of take you through each one of these five different categories of junk and show you where geneticists are beginning to discover that they're not as junky as they thought by looking for purposes in areas besides providing blueprints for the proteins. They're finding that it actually has a useful purpose. So, for example, with the pseudogenes, number one, they're finding that some of them actually do code to build proteins. We used to think that they weren't blueprints for making proteins, but many of them actually are. So a lot of what they called pseudogenes are real genes. But what about the rest of them? The rest of them, they discovered, protect protein coding genes from breakdown or malfunction. So you can think of the pseudogenes as the bodyguards for the genes. They make sure that they're protected from being damaged or broken down or from not functioning appropriately. So just like some of us need bodyguards, evidently a few of the genes need bodyguards as well. Yeah, all right. Yeah, quality control. That'd be a good way to put it. But some of them are actually genes. Well, what about the short interspersed nuclear elements? Geneticists are discovering that they protect the cell from stress. And just like all of us here experience stress, cells experience stress, temperature stress or chemical stress. And so these short interspersed nuclear elements are protecting the cell from stress, and some of them regulate the expression of the protein coding genes. In other words, they determine this is where you're supposed to function, and you're supposed to function for this period of time, then you need to shut down. And this is something that we're recognizing explains one reason why our genome, quote, looks as junky as it does. We take the longest to develop. I mean, from the time that you're conceived to the time that you're fully functional as an adult, well, some might argue that's 35 years, but just in terms of the physicality, it's probably in the neighborhood of 24 to 25 years for men and 22 to 23 years for women. Women develop a little faster than men, particularly the way the brain functions, so which is why I'm telling my sons, you know, it's good to really think about a bride when you're in your mid-20s as opposed to in your teenage years, because your brain hasn't caught up to the brain of the gal that you might be dating. That's off the point here. So But I think there's, well, I'm speaking as a father, okay? But the whole point is, because we do take so long, literally more than two decades to develop, and moreover, we don't have ordinary development, we have a very complex development. I mean, for example, the human brain is only the third the size of an adult brain at birth. So, you know, all that brain growth takes place. Something's got to control that growth. And so just as I was mentioning this gal from Caltech saying, you know, control is a lot more challenging than the actual operation of the complexity. Well, because of just how long we take to develop and how complex our development is, we would expect that a really large chunk of our genome would indeed be governing that control and regulation. So it's regulation and control. But what about the long interspersed nuclear elements? Some inactivate the X chromosome so as to prevent genetic disorders. And so, you know, you got two different sets of chromosomes for the male as opposed to the female. And if you don't turn certain components of the sex chromosomes off, then you're going to be propagating genetic defects.
What's the long name for lines?
Oh, long interspersed nuclear elements. So some serve that function of making sure that the sex chromosomes or portions of the sex chromosomes are inactivated to prevent genetic disorders, and others turn off one or two genes that are inherited from the organism's parents. So you get a gene from the father, a gene from the mother, but you're going to want to shut off one of those genes. And the lines will do that for you. Well, probably the one that's been the subject of most debate are these endogenous retroviruses. Are they really viruses that have been incorporated over a long history of evolution? There's a spelling error there, sorry about that. Do they actually serve some function that we've not been aware of? Well, research is still going on these endogenous retroviruses, but what they notice for a large chunk of them is that they actually disrupt the life cycle of invading viruses. So rather than being an actual virus, it's actually a section of our genome that protects us from viral attack. And because we live so long, 80, 90, 100 years, and because there's so many of us, and we share viruses so frequently with one another and with other forms of life, we human beings of all species need a lot of protection against viral attack. And these endogenous retroviruses serve that function of making sure we don't get killed off too quickly by the viruses. And then what about the LTRs? Some protect the organism from retroviral attacks. So in other words, they're kind of like the endogenous retroviruses. They're designed to protect the genome from viral attacks, and others regulate the expression of certain protein-coding genes. Now, this explains what has been released in the ENCODE project about a month ago now. If you want to know about the ENCODE project, you can go online and read today's New Reasons to Believe articles that Fuzz has been writing, our staff biochemist. He's also done now, I think, about a half dozen podcasts on the ENCODE project, which is basically a concession from evolutionists working in the field of genetics that is not 98% junk. It's less than 20% junk. And moreover, there may not be any junk at all. So that's kind of, as Fuzz explains, in terms of genetics, it's probably the most important set of research papers published in the last 15 years. Because it basically is transforming the whole debate, whether it's creation or evolution. It's really making a very strong case that what we see in the genomes of all life forms is common design, not common descent. Yes?
And this is the difference between the endogenous retrovirals and the LTRs. They look pretty much like you're saying the same thing.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's kind of what's happening, is that they realize it's just about the same thing, although with some of the LTRs, they're actually playing a role as control systems, determining when certain molecules should be built and where they should be placed. So it's, again, governing the development of it. And this is where it stands as of now. And if you read our book, Who is Adam? It's not that they've identified 100% of the function within the cell, but it's very much more than 2%. In fact, the majority of the genome now has established function, and if we keep studying the rest of it, we may figure it out. And a lot of it, too, is determining whether we're looking at an endogenous virus or an LTR. So there's some debate there over how we should identify the different components of the genome. And, you know, as Fuzz points out in the podcast, there may be additional areas of design that we've not yet discovered. But as it is, the vast majority of the human genome has now been identified not to be junk and to serve critical function. As I said, the people who published the ENCODE papers, none of whom are creationists, have all said it's at least 80% functional, and maybe it's even close to 100%. It's at least 80%, and it may be 100%. Yes.
Maybe this is a simple question, but how much of the, quote, junk DNA is used only for prenatal development and, you know, developing this thing, and then we don't need it anymore, so it's just residing until it's passed on to the next baby?
Right.
And I didn't hear that covered in here.
Well, okay, what I said 2 weeks ago is that when we talk about these control systems, they're basically telling different parts of the genome, this is when you turn on, and this is when you turn off. And this is where you're supposed to operate, and this is where you're not supposed to operate. And so, for example, cancer is often a symptom of these control features not operating the way they should.
Like
so,
marfans, where you just grow.
Yeah.
Or stop growing. That would be a disruption. Because you're supposed to stop growing at some point.
Well,
you know.
That's where a lot of this research is going, is actually looking at defects that we see in certain genetic defects we see in individual, and looking at those genetic defects, trying to figure out where they are in the genome, what went wrong, and what was supposed to happen. So, I mean, one way that you could say we're subject to the law of decay is that there will be certain ones of us within the 7 billion human population that will have a certain genetic defects. In fact, I think I can share this with all of you. If you were to study your genome in sufficient depth, I'll bet you would find a defect. Okay? You're all defected human beings in one respect or another. In fact, that's actually a biblical statement. 2 Corinthians 4 makes the point that we're all defective human beings, at least at a spiritual level. But even maybe there might be some application at a physical level. I've certainly got some genetic defects. And my sons have genetic defects I don't have. So it's something that's fairly common to the human species. Yes.
Why do the ribosomes have their own DNA?
Well, maybe I can have Rich here answer that question. You're kind of the ribosome expert. I've been seeing some of your stuff. Got anything to say on that?
The ribosomes don't have their own DNA. The ribosomes are made of RNA.
Right.
Oh, the mitochondria. Okay.
Yeah.
Why do they have their own?
It controls, there are a set of genes within the mitochondria which control some of the proteins that are encoded in the mitochondria. So it's sort of a weird.
And it comes from your mother, too. Mitochondrial DNA.
Can blame your mom for some things and your dad for other things, right? Or since this is November, you can thank your mom for certain things and your dad for other things. So, yeah, when I made the comment about the fact that we're all defective in some form, well, the amazing thing is that we're mostly functional. You know, we got tiny defects, but we have this amazing high degree of functionality. And, you know, when you look at, and that's kind of what you're seeing in Psalm 139, when you look at human beings, we're amazing by orders of magnitude compared to all their life forms. Look how long we get to live. Look how big our bodies are. Look how complex our bodies are. And look at all we can do within the course of our lifespan. No animal even comes close. I mean, one thing we've noticed, for example, with human beings, we have 4 times the number of heartbeats in our lifetime that other mammalian species have. As I mentioned 2 weeks ago, you know, we have 2 cats in our household, and one of our cats is 18 years of age. and that cat is now suffering from fairly severe dementia. Well, it takes 18 years for a cat to develop that level of dementia.
What are the symptoms?
What are the symptoms?
Becomes relational, right?
I love cats.
He's thinking that's the case with all cats. Now, I'll tell you what we've observed with our cat, Nico, is that now that he's gotten on in years, and 18 is way beyond the normal lifespan of a cat, and we're in trouble because I took him to the vet, and he said, this cat's going to live at least another decade. So we're going to have to put up this for quite a while. But how the dementia is being manifested, in the middle of the night, our cat will forget where he is. And so he goes around the house screaming his lungs out, trying to find people. And then when he does find us, he wants to know where his food dish is, where the water is, and wants a lot of pets to be reassured. And this will happen like four or five times throughout the middle of the night. So, you know, it's kind of like having a baby that wakes up every couple of hours.
You should get him a cat.
He has a cat. He's got another cat that tries to wait on him hand and foot, but he really wants to be reassured as to. And so, yeah, he'll actually forget that he's eaten, and so he'll eat too much and throw it up. So then we got to clean that up. So what we're now doing is giving him food in just tiny amounts, so that when he does eat it, we know he's going to forget. And so. But, you know, that's kind of off the point. Because, you know, my point was, that's kind of the norm for other mammalian species of life here on planet Earth, but it's not the norm for us human beings. I mean, yeah, today we have a dementia problem in the human species, but that's because we have a lifespan that's significantly longer than in the days when they first brought out Social Security. You know, they brought out Social Security in the 1930s, and they made the time when you could take Social Security age 65. Did you know what the life expectancy of the average American was back in the 1930s? 67. And so if you want to know why Social Security is in danger of bankrupting our nation, it's because it was originally designed to provide protection for 2 years. Now it's providing protection for 25 years. You know, part of that expense is when you get into your 80s and 90s, the probability of you suffering dementia is considerably is a considerable factor, and that causes expense. But the amazing thing is, with us human beings, it literally takes that long for that kind of a problem to settle in to the human being.
But some people in their 80s and 90s, they live long. Some people don't suffer that problem.
That's particularly true of my Nova Scotia relatives. They all live into their 90s. I'm hoping I got their genes. But none of them have ever had dementia, even though they live up to 96, 97. But I can tell you one thing about my Nova Scotia relatives. In spite of what I think is a pretty bad diet that they eat, they stay incredibly physically active. So even though I've had aunts that lived into their 90s, they were swimming in their 90s and, you know, swimming a mile or two. So, I mean, they kept themselves really active. And studies show that that does play a role in staving off dementia. In fact, that's what our veterinarian said about our second cat, who's now 11 years of age, that we need to make sure that we exercise that cat so that when that cat gets to be 18, it doesn't have the dementia symptoms.
How are you spelling exercise?
Yeah. Well, okay, I'll tell you another story. This is at Caltech. And they're wondering about, you know, well, how do we test? Because you know what happens at Caltech is that the scientists never retire. You know, they just keep working on and on. They keep publishing papers into their 80s. I mean, I'm amazed as I pick up the Astrophysical Journal, I'm reading articles that have been published by my professors that I had at the University of Toronto. I know they're in their 80s and 90s, and they're still very actively publishing. But the whole point is, how do you know when a scientist is beginning to suffer the signs of dementia and needs to retire? Well, they used to give these scientists a standard test for dementia. In other words, do you know what day of the week it is? Well, I can tell you, a scientist in his 30s won't know what day of the week it is. So that's not going to work. What are the names of your children? They're probably not going to be able to pull that off either. So, or important dates. I mean, they won't know that. Their phone number, they won't know that. And so they had to come up with a whole new way to test for dementia with scientists. And one they came up with is, do you know what the Navier-Stokes equation is in polar coordinates? If they can immediately rattle that off, they don't have dementia. But if they can't, then you know they're beginning to suffer the signs of dementia. So they kind of go through the whole test that way. All right, let me move on here. We've actually got a few more minutes. I actually think I might be able to finish this. Okay. I want to finish up here with some DNA tests for the Garden of Eden hypothesis. And if you read the scientific literature on human origins and genetics, you'll see this phrase in the research papers, the Garden of Eden hypothesis. You'll also see a number of papers that are talking about the genetic Adam and the genetic Eve. What you see in these research papers, and this is something we talk about in our book, Who is Adam, is that because of how compelling the evidence is for what we see recorded in the pages of the Bible, they're actually using biblical terms to describe the research, even though the researchers are not Christians. Many of them are atheists, but they recognize that we're seeing this link. So, for example, what Fuzz and I talk about in Who is Adam is that years ago when we were graduate students, they were talking about the multi-regional hypothesis, that we human beings came from multiple ancestors of multiple regions. The Bible says we came from one region and one ancestor. Well, the DNA evidence is now very compelling that the multi-regional hypothesis is incorrect and that we do come from a single region and a single ancestral population. And this is based on mitochondrial DNA studies and Y chromosome DNA studies. Now, why these studies are useful? With mitochondrial DNA, we all have it. Men and women have mitochondrial DNA, but you only get it from your mothers. Your father does not contribute to your mitochondrial DNA. So mitochondrial DNA is an excellent tool for tracing the ancestry of human beings because there's no mixing of that DNA in sexual intercourse. You only get it from your mother. So the only way my mitochondrial DNA can be different from my mother's is if I suffer a mutation in my mitochondrial DNA. And so they can actually look at mitochondrial DNA throughout the human population. And where it's really helpful is actually if you can dig up some people who have been dead for a number of generations and measure their mitochondrial DNA and get some measure of the natural mutation rate in that DNA, then you can actually make some useful conclusions about the origin of human beings. And what that mitochondrial DNA shows is that we are descended from one or a few females. Now, if you read the evolutionary literature, say 20 years ago, they were saying that we're descended from a small population of only a million ancestral human beings. Then it dropped to 100,000. And if you were to read Francis Collins' book, he's a Christian who's a theistic evolutionist, he said 10,000. But the position of BioLogos today is 1,200. But what has always been true about these mitochondrial DNA studies is that the data is consistent with all of us being descended from one woman only. Now, what evolutionists are doing in response is to say, well, maybe there was a bunch of Eves. In fact, I've got a book in my office called The Seven Eves, which makes the point that the DNA of six of the Eves died out and only one survived. So in that sense, we're descended from a single woman. That's kind of where the debate is running. The data is consistent with all of us being descended from just one woman. And the scientific literature, they call her the mitochondrial Eve. So if you were to look at a PBS special on human origins, don't be surprised if they're talking about Eve. This is what they're referring to. And as you look at that mitochondrial DNA, what you'll typically see in the documentaries on television and some of the research papers is that first woman lived in Eastern or Central Africa. But actually, as you look at the data, you discover that the error bars are sufficiently large that it's similar within 2,000 miles of the juncture of Africa, Asia, and Europe. So we haven't exactly pinned down through mitochondrial DNA the location of the Garden of Eden, but it is in the right ballpark compared to what the Bible talks about. And if you read the different theologians, some theologians have argued that the Garden of Eden was in the Nile. Others have argued that it's in the Persian Gulf area or Mesopotamia. Some have argued that it may be in Persia. So there's even some debate amongst Bible scholars as to where that Garden of Eden is. I personally think the Garden of Eden is in what is now the southeastern portion of the Persian Gulf, simply based on what we see in Genesis 2, which tells us that the Garden of Eden is at the juncture of four known rivers, two of which are now dry, the Pihon and the Gishon, which flow through southern Arabia, and two that are still flowing vigorously, the Tigris and the Euphrates. But there's really only one place in the world where they come together in one location, and that's the southeastern portion of the Persian Gulf. Anyway, that is consistent with the mitochondrial DNA evidence. And if you read the scientific literature, they actually refer to this location identified by mitochondrial DNA as the Garden of Eden. Hence the term in the scientific literature, the Garden of Eden hypothesis. As for a date, typically what you'll see is 150,000 years ago, and some have tried to push it to 200,000 years ago. I've seen dates as low as 120,000 years ago. But all of these dates assume that every human being gets one set of mitochondrial DNA from their mother. The truth is, 10% of us in this room get two sets. 1% gets three sets. And so we call that triplasmy if you got three sets from your mother, and we call it heteroplasmy if you got two sets from your mother. And I wrote an article on this, almost 20 years ago now. It's actually archived on our website, making the point that if you take into account heteroplasmy, it divides the date by one-third, and if you take into account triplasmy, it chops off a few more years beyond that, giving you a rough date for when this first woman would have lived of about 50,000 years ago. So, and if you look at that mitochondrial DNA, human mitochondrial DNA, and this is where you actually compare DNA of humans alive in the world today in different ethnic groups, and then look at the mitochondrial DNA in people that they've dug up where they got a good date from when they lived. And you say, how far back can you go? About 25,000 years of some reliability. Some have tried to push it back 30,000 years. But when we do that, what we discover is we can't measure any significant change in the mitochondrial DNA over those few tens of thousands of years. So it's showing that the human genome, at least in the context of mitochondrial DNA, does not experience anywhere near the degree of evolution to support a common descent model. The rate of evolution is very low and therefore makes the argument that we're not the product of evolution. By the way, those same studies have been done with over 20 specimens of Neanderthals, where they look at Neanderthals over their whole geographical range from Spain all the way to Siberia, and from about 48,000 years ago to 150,000 years ago, and they draw the same conclusion, that we cannot measure any significant change in the mitochondrial DNA of the Neanderthals. Not at all surprising, because we are mammalian species, and studies have already demonstrated if you're looking at mammals with large body sizes, you're not going to get rapid evolution. Yes?
If you can go back 150,000 years.
Right.
DNA.
Well, you're coming about a 100,000-year window, from 150 to about 50.
Why can't they get some Homo erectus DNA, which goes down to maybe 30,000?
Okay. With Homo erectus, you're looking at 200,000 years ago to about 2 million years ago, although some would say only 1.8 million. Well, 200,000 is about... I haven't heard 100,000, but I have heard 200. 200,000 is far enough back in time, you will not get any credible DNA. over that period of time, the DNA will decay. And by the way, one of our scientists just wrote an article on this, using this as a refutation of young Earth creationism. The very fact that we see DNA that is so corrupted that we can't reconstruct the genome proves it's got to be old, older than what any young Earth model would predict. But with Neanderthals, you're talking sufficiently close to the present that the Neanderthal, the DNA does have corruption in it. In fact, they're saying about it, it's about 67% pristine, and the rest of it is corrupted. But just looking at the part that is pristine, we can't measure any significant change in the DNA. So, contrasting that with the... Yeah, I got a question over here, sorry.
So you say the DNA... Well, we go back to a female ancestor 50,000 years, I say. So what would a scientist, whether he's an atheist or not, I mean, then where did that first human come from? Was it from a, I guess, not an ape? Was it from God? What's the consensus?
Well, the evolutionists would say that it's not just one woman. We're looking at an ancestral population that may have been as large as 1,200 individuals. But that is something I want to point out to you, is that they're basically pushing the models to get the biggest ancestral population possible. And over the past 20 years, that biggest possible number has been dropping, literally from 1 million to 100,000 to 10,000, now down to 1,200. I wouldn't be surprised if it shrinks all the way down to one. That could happen.
That one person, would then they say it's God, it's
divine? Well, if it gets down to one, that forces the biblical worldview model, that we're not the product of evolution or the product of special creation. However, you're asking, how do the evolutionists defend this? They're trying to push that ancestral population to as large a figure as possible and trying to work out theoretical genomics models that will keep that number large, and also trying to push the date back, and then arguing that we're really the product of common descent, not special creation. So this is a very fertile area of debate that's going on right now, and we are actually going to be adding a chapter to Who is Adam, and Fuzz told me it looks like it's going to be 100 pages long, that chapter, because what we're doing is actually responding to the evolutionary attempts to try to get past that single woman, keep the number large, and basically what Fuzz is doing is critiquing the genomics models that are making that number as large as it is, and making the point, as I've already demonstrated in past weeks, that these genomics models pushing the evolutionary paradigm are not consistent with field experiments. Field experiments that show that we generate a very large amount of genetic diversity with a small ancestral population. Because that's basically what the evolutionists are doing. They're looking at the diversity of human mitochondrial DNA right now and saying based on that DNA, we must have been descended from a large population. But their experiments where they start with, say, two sheep or two horses and let them run for a few generations, and they wind up with way more diversity in the resultant population than what their evolutionary models would predict.
Just one quick question. Scientists, do they believe in the Darwin theory of evolution now, or is that debunked? What's the stance?
Depends which scientists you talk to. I mean, you can pick up my book there, Hidden Treasures in the Book of Job, where we have people working in neuroscience who are actually looking at the way the mind of a cat or a dog or an ape functions relative to the mind of a human being, and basically concluding that Darwin got it wrong, that the properties of our mind are not the result of common descent. Because if you were to compare the human mind with all the other animals, our closest ancestor would not be the chimpanzee, it would be a raven. And yet that would not fit the physical properties. I mean, physically, we're not at all similar to ravens. They have wings, we do not. They're tiny, we're big. So that's a significant challenge. But there are people who are challenging on the level of morphology, too, just looking at the anatomy of the human being and comparing it with the anatomy of the great apes. There are significant differences. I discovered I'm out of time. Next week we're going to get to the Y chromosome thing. And if you could read ahead to Psalm 147 and 148, where it talks about stars and rainfall and different aspects of creation, then we can jump into that. Let me close in prayer. Father in heaven, we do thank you for the progress we made today. Thank you, Lord, that we are fearfully and wonderfully made. Lord, that is by your hand that we're here upon planet Earth. That literally your hand was upon us when we were conceived in our mother's womb. That we're not just physical beings. We are soulish. We have a mind. We have emotions. We have intellect and volition. We're also spiritual. We thank you, God, that you created us as spiritual beings. And because we're spiritual, we know that we're going to live beyond this life here on Earth. Lord, that there is an afterlife. And Lord, that through our spirit, we're going to be able to enjoy fellowship with one another and with you for the rest of eternity. Father, I pray that you prepare each one of us right now and throughout this week to come to receive that eternal fellowship with you and with people who choose to receive you as Creator, Lord, and Savior. So, Father, I pray that you'd help each one of us to humble ourselves before you and receive your light, your truth, and your love. In Jesus' name, amen.